Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Nigel Cameron. I have the honour to chair the advisory board for the BioCentre. Pleasure to welcome you to this, our next conference. The centre has been going now in various forms for more than 20 years, and we have in the past had a conference here, usually at the RSM every year or so, and we're going to increase the pace over the next few months for those who have stamina and like interesting or dull afternoons, depending upon your taste. And we're delighted to welcome you to the first of our series on global perspectives on biopolicy, with its particular focus on the UNESCO Universal Declaration on Bioethics and Human Rights, which is the first global instrument on bioethics, or depending how you want to use language here, on the questions raised by bioethics, and which has interesting connections and contrasts with the European Convention on Human Rights and Bioethics, which we're also going to be addressing through one of our respondents. So those are the topics for the afternoon. We're delighted to have three very distinguished presenters with us this afternoon. And I want to introduce, first of all, our keynote speech from Professor Jan Helga Solbach, who has very recently been appointed as head of the Division of Bioethics at UNESCO. And therefore, as I was saying to him earlier, we can't blame him or praise him, perhaps, for the declaration, because he has inherited it rather than devised it. And we are delighted he's able to join us, and you will find his biographical information in the materials. Delighted to have him join us as our opening presenter. Program for the afternoon you have in the pack. My two colleagues at BioCentre, Rachel Bell and Matt James, will respectively introduce the two other presenters, and so you'll be able to see who they are also. As the afternoon goes on, we have a break after this initial speech, and then later in the afternoon, we will have some time for questions. We'll save our questions for panel discussion with all three of our speakers. I think we have enough time this afternoon for a certain laxity in the timing. I think we have enough time for people to be able to make some serious presentations and then still time for our panel discussion. So do prepare your own questions for that time when it comes. And then a little after 6 o'clock, when we've finished, we will have a reception with some drinks somewhere out there in other rooms we'll be directed to. And we hope also there'll be an opportunity there for some private discussion, both with you and also, of course, for you with our speakers. So, welcome, thank you very much, and I am particularly glad to welcome Professor Solbach. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cameron, for this kind invitation. While waiting for my slides, let me just briefly say something about the division in which I worked. I have been at the UNESCO headquarters since February 14th this year, so it's quite recently. UNESCO decided 4 years ago to make ethics one of its areas of priority. So UNESCO has a division on ethics in science and technology. The director of this division is Professor Henk ten Hafer from the Netherlands. The division is divided into two sections, one for bioethics and one for ethics in science and technology. And I'm then the head of the bioethics section. I will come back to some details a bit later in my presentation. Could you make it full screen there, or is it not possible? Not full screen here. Okay. So here you see the main building of the UNESCO headquarters in Paris, the Fontenoy building. Personally, I'm happy to work in another building because the other building has the name Bonvin. As you, perhaps not all of you know, UNESCO was established in November 1945 and is the only UN agency which has science as its prime responsibility, besides education and culture. There are certainly other UN agencies that also have science activities, for example, WHO, responsible for medicine, including also medical research. But UNESCO is, in a way, the United Nations' main agency for this field of human knowledge. I will start with, I think, four preambles. And the first, I would like to reflect a bit upon what is a declaration. A declaration may be drafted and adopted by individuals. I hereby declare. Some of you are probably married. You made there a declaration. May be drafted and adopted by interest groups, by non-governmental organizations, by governmental organizations, as well as by intergovernmental organizations. Declarations are, legally speaking, not binding. They are only binding according to the law or morals. That is important to take into account. In this respect, declarations are similar to guidelines but different from conventions. Some examples. You all know about the Declaration of Helsinki. Perhaps some of you also know quite well SIAM's International Ethical Guidelines for Biomedical Research involving human subjects. These are, morally speaking, binding for members of the World Medical Associations and of members of the International Council on Medical Sciences. While, for example, the European Council's Convention on Human Rights and Biomedicine is legally binding for those member states of the Council of Europe which has adopted the convention. Second preamble. What characterizes UNESCO's Universal Declaration of Bioethics and Human Rights? First, it consists of five chapters. A chapter on general provisions, a chapter on principles, a chapter on application of the principles, a chapter on promotion of the declaration, and some final provisions. The declaration contains 15 articles addressing morally binding principles. Here are the principles: human dignity and human rights, benefit and harm, autonomy and individual responsibility, consent, vulnerability, privacy and confidentiality, equality, justice and equity, non-discrimination and non-stigmatization, respect for cultural diversity and pluralism, solidarity and cooperation, social responsibility, sharing of benefits, protection of future generations, protection of the environment, the biosphere, and biodiversity. There are 15 articles addressing these ethical values and principles. Third preamble, what makes UNESCO's Universal Declaration on Bioethics and Human Rights special? What is special with this declaration? First, it is the first international ethics instrument that deals with the linkage between human rights and bioethics, the first international ethics instrument. That's important to take into account. Second, it is the first normative instrument that provides the international community with global bioethics standards. Third, it is the first international ethics instrument which the UN member states have adopted. That in itself is extremely important to take into account when reading the declaration, when criticizing the declaration. It is something extremely important that 192 member states adopted this declaration in 2003. It is the first international ethics instrument which the UN member states have committed themselves to implement in their own countries. In Article 22 of the declaration, the role of member states is explicitly mentioned. I quote, "States should take all appropriate measures, whether of a legislative, administrative, or other character, to give effect to the principles set out in this declaration in accordance with international human rights law." And exactly this statement makes also this declaration different, for example, from the Declaration of Helsinki. Although many countries now, in particular in the Western part of the world, have legislation which complies very well with the Declaration of Helsinki, no states have any legal or moral responsibility for implementing the Declaration of Helsinki in their legislations, in their guidelines, etc. But the member states of UNESCO have a responsibility with regard to that. So in a way, probably it's important also to distinguish between declarations. Declarations made by non-governmental organizations may have a strong moral bearing, and the Declaration of Helsinki is an excellent example of that. It has had a tremendous influence on the normative and legislative work in biomedical research in very many countries worldwide. But this declaration is, in a way, although it is not strictly speaking legally binding, it is closer to legislation than the Declaration of Helsinki. And it's very interesting to read Article 22, the way it is phrased, to set out in this declaration in accordance with international human rights law. So it, in a way, this declaration is based on an internationally binding legal framework. The Declaration on Helsinki is, in a way, you could call it kind of soft law. This is not hard law, but it is harder than soft law. Third preamble, what is the role of UNESCO in relation to its declaration? Well, in Article 25 of the Declaration, UNESCO's responsibility in this respect is stated. UNESCO shall promote and disseminate the principles set out in this declaration. And that brings me back to the division where I work. Section for Bioethics is responsible for the secretariat of three international agencies or committees. The first is the International Bioethics Committee. The International Bioethics Committee has 36 members. In name, these members should be experts in bioethics. During the discussion, we can come back to that. What constitutes and experts in bioethics? What should be the requirements? But what is important to take into account is that these 36 members, one from each of the 36, or one from each member state, they represent only themselves. They do not represent the member states. So after a period of maximum 6 years, I think. New members have to be selected. The members are selected by the Director General of UNESCO. Member states may suggest names, but it is the Director General who select these members. The second committee which we are in charge of is the IBGC, the Intergovernmental Bioethics Committee, which also has 36 members. These members are selected by the member states, and these members do not represent themselves, but the countries. The third committee is, or a body called the Interagency Committee, which is a committee trying to coordinate the different ethics activities in the different UN bodies, WHO, UNESCO, and all the other UN bodies. The second section, the section of ethics in science and technology, they have a committee with the acronym COMEST, which also consists of experts in ethics. So COMEST is the analog to IBC. I should come back to what are the responsibilities of these two bodies later in my presentation. So let me now try to go into the work we try to do from the division and from the section of bioethics, to look at some of the challenges in trying to promote this declaration, trying to do the work the UNESCO division is meant to do. First is the challenge related to the ethics infrastructure. How could we contribute to establishment and running of ethics committees? How can we contribute in ethics teaching, in building up ethics expertise, in promoting research in ethics, and in promoting international and national cooperation? The second challenge relates to the level of legislation, the level of regulation. And here we have also some very, very delicate challenges. Bioethics is an American invention in terms of name, certainly not in terms of substance. But there is no doubt that bioethics today is a discipline where the Western and Occidental voices are the strongest voices. When we try to promote bioethics as a kind of global enterprise, then we have to deal with some very delicate issues. Universalism versus cultural diversity. How can we at the same time strive to establish global bioethics standards and at the same time observe, respect cultural diversity, respect pluralism? The second delicate issue is ethics versus religion. I think that one of the paradoxes today is that, in a way, although technically speaking and in many other ways we are more advanced than ever, we also see that religion is a reality which throughout the last years have become more and more visible. In a way, one of the dogmas of modernity was that religion will fade away. And what we see today is in many ways the opposite. That is also important to take into account in this context. Third, the risk of different standards. Should there be, if there should be a kind of universal bioethics, how should we cope with the risk of different standards? The challenge related to, well, it is different promoting bioethics in the UK than in Malawi. Because in the UK, you have a lot of already existing infrastructures with whom or in relation to which it is possible to communicate. Also the challenge of how to make ethicists, ethics experts, interact with policymakers. Around 25 years ago, President Jimmy Carter launched human rights as a political issue, and people laughed at this seemingly stupid idea. No politician today who wants to be taken seriously have at least to pretend that he or she takes human rights seriously. I think we now are in a period of history where bioethics starts playing the same role. Bioethics has become a very important political issue. And we see how bioethics deliberations play a stronger and stronger, more important role in political discourses. And if that is true, then ethics experts in academia have a responsibility which perhaps is different from the standard responsibilities of an academic. How to do bioethics in a way that communicate with policymakers. The third challenge, the Western-Northern bias of ethics. Looking at publications in different bioethics journals, there is an overemphasis and overfocus on advanced technologies. Nanotechnology, neuroscience, pre-implantation diagnosis, these are all extremely fascinating technologies from a moral point of view. But these are technologies that, for the time being, and probably for many, many years to come, technologies that will be implemented in the richest part of the world. In bioethics today, there is still an emphasis on individual decision making. There is still an overemphasized focus on ethical issues affecting the rich. And also the issue of commercialization and commodification of science and technology. All these are important issues, but in a global context, perhaps not the most important issues of bioethics. So when we try to promote this declaration, we act along these four dimensions: dissemination, promotion, application, elaboration. And when it comes to dissemination, many national UNESCO commissions have already made translations of the Universal Declaration. And some of the member countries have also made small brochures with these declarations. There has since 2003 come out a lot of publications where their Universal Declaration is addressed. The German UNESCO Commission published a book in 2006. A Spanish book has been published, a French one, an Italian one. Books where the declaration and challenges with these declaration, this declaration is addressed. There has been, since the declaration was adopted, a lot of publications in journals, critical, and some articles that also praises the declaration. And we find also legal references to the declaration. When it comes to promotion, Henk ten Hoffe, whom I referred to at the start of my presentation, he has then been participating in a whole range of rotating conferences where the declaration has been addressed. New Zealand, Peru, Denmark, Slovakia, Togo, the Dominican Republic, and this summer we hope to have a similar rotating conference in Georgia. And he has also then been invited to a whole range of conferences worldwide to present the declaration. But I think this conference is the first conference in the UK where UNESCO's declaration has been the main focus of attention. And this is important because a written declaration, if it's not communicated, if it's not promoted, if it's not debated, then it's dead as the paper it's written on. But how do you communicate the content, the substance of a declaration? A complex challenge. Then let's move to application. In the division, we try to promote capacity building. Capacity building is one of the main responsibilities of UNESCO, all the UNESCO activities, capacity building. And when it comes then to capacity building within this domain, how do we proceed? Well, the first sort of capacity building is the so-called Global Ethics Observatory. I should come back to that. The second, ethics education program, and the third, an ABC, assisting bioethics committees. I don't like acronyms, and UNESCO is full of acronyms, and the first days I struggled to understand all these acronyms floating around. But I like this last acronym, ABC. It's a wonderful metaphor for assisting bioethics committees. The Global Ethics Observatory is a collection of, at present, three databases. The aim of these databases is to collect information of relevance for bioethics. So the first database contains information about bioethics experts. Who's who in bioethics? And Henk and a group of advisors have then developed a criteria for labeling yourself a bioethics expert. And one of the important criteria is that you have published something in a bioethics journal about bioethics. And just to illustrate the importance of that, 1.5 week ago, I was in Kenya to plan the next IBC meeting because it will take place in Nairobi in May. And the first day of the meeting is dedicated to African perspectives in bioethics. And we had asked the local planners of this day to identify bioethics experts. And then before traveling to Nairobi, I went to this database and found 24 names of African bioethics experts with their publications, and I could bring their files to the meeting, and we were discussing. And one of the delicate problems that always happen when you try to promote ethics in different countries is that there is a tendency to invite as experts old friends, good friends, important people. And then suddenly, during that meeting, they have been transformed into bioethics experts. But we had a very, very fruitful dialogue, and we ended up with full consensus on who should be invited. So such a database is important. It's also important that it is a database where the people have been assessed according to the same standards, to the same criteria. The second database is a database about ethics institutions, committees, centers, departments, etc., worldwide, which is also very important. I shall come back to why. And the third database is a database about existing teaching programs in bioethics and science ethics worldwide. What is it out there? If you want to promote, if you want to act, then you have to know what is already there. And just to take a look at the Global Ethics Observatory. In the first database, we have already 824 experts. I felt ashamed when I came to UNESCO. I hadn't sent in my file. So the first thing I had to do was to see whether I qualified. In the second database, we have so far data about 203 existing institutions. And in the third database, we have so far collected 109 teaching programs. That is not me. I am just starting to enter this field. These databases were launched in December 2005. They have a worldwide coverage. They are freely accessible. And all the data in these databases are translated into the 6 official languages of UNESCO: Arabic, Russian, Spanish, English, French, and Chinese, which is in itself a huge task, important in the name of communication. Then we are now in the process of establishing a fourth database, a database about ethics-related legislation and guidelines and declarations and conventions. And the way Henk has then proceeded in this field is first to establish a review committee of legal experts with the responsibility to identify criteria that makes it possible to analyze and compare existing legislations worldwide. And the first group of countries which have been then the object of this analysis is Australia, Brazil, Canada, Ethiopia, Hungary, Japan, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia. And Henk and members of this group is working on this first collection today. That's one of the reasons he couldn't come today. Then, and the results of this will be launched in Nairobi in May at the IBC meeting. The second group of countries which will be the object of the same analysis is then Egypt, Finland, Germany, Indonesia, Israel, South Africa, and the South Pacific countries. And the aim is to map all existing ethics relevant legislations worldwide. The second activity is this ethics education program. And to promote or to proceed with such a program, it is extremely important to have these empirical data about experts in ethics, about existing teaching programs. And so far, the division has then gathered information about existing teaching programs in the Arab region and in Southeast Europe and West Asia. And there has been organized several then regional expert meetings on ethics teaching in Tehran, in Muscat. At the beginning of this month, we went to Istanbul, and around 60 existing teaching programs in Turkey, in Georgia, in Macedonia, in Cyprus, I forgot one country, were presented. And what we try then to do here also is to ask people to fill in a standard form so that it is possible again to make comparisons between the different teaching programs in terms of objectives, in terms of topics, teaching hours, etc., etc. And because these databases are accessible to everyone, you can go into this database and look at, okay, what exists in my own country? At least that is the long-term goal, to be able to map what exists worldwide. We also try, certainly, one way of promoting is to look into how often are UNESCO documents used, referred to, applied in these teaching programs. Let me then move to these IBC activities. Many Western countries have already established national bioethics committees or national ethics committees or national research ethics committees. The UK doesn't have a national bioethics committee, but it has an excellent committee established by Nuffield Council. What we know, for example, if you take the field of biomedical research, what is taking place now is that many of the huge pharmaceutical companies, they are transferring their activities to countries lacking these institutions. Africa, South America, etc. So this ABC activity is, morally speaking, one of the most important activities to try to help member states establish national bioethics committees so that at least a decent minimum of control systems are established. And also here, an expert group has been working to try to develop procedures that may function. And as part of that activity, this expert committee has also tried to draft a core curriculum in bioethics based on the declaration, based on the 15 articles in the declaration. A course that can be used in the member states to actively promote the substance of the declaration. And the first meeting where this curriculum will be presented will be a meeting in Kenya in July this year. As part of the ethics education program, one of the main priorities is to teach teachers or to build up young teachers in the member states that may have the responsibility in teaching their own students ethics. How do we teach ethics? That is, philosophically speaking, a very interesting question. When we teach people ethics, what do we really teach them? When we learn ethics, what is it? What kind of learning is that? Is it to remember some principles? Is it to apply some principles, to balance principles, to specify principles, or is it something more? And is it possible to develop a kind of universal method of ethics teaching? Or do we have to observe cultural diversities? It was very interesting at this meeting in Istanbul, a prominent Turkish philosopher said that we have to get rid of all religious ethics. It shouldn't be there. London, November 2 years ago, at the International Stem Cell Conference, several people in the audience during the debate said, we will solve the dilemmas in stem cell research if we get rid of the religious voices. I think that is very, very problematic. How do we deal with ethics based on different foundations? Rational, religious, pragmatic, political, etc. And when it comes to these ethics teaching courses, October 30th till November 4th last year, there was a pilot course testing out this model in Bucharest in Romania. And as I said, the core curriculum, which is now in the process of being fulfilled, will then be tried out in Nairobi in July 2007, and then we plan one in Bratislava in Slovakia in September this year. Another activity is to produce material that the member states may use. Many of the member states, they do not have money to subscribe to existing bioethics journals. There is no money for that. So one of the activities which is also prioritized is to produce material that may be used for free by the member states. Materials on ethics and policy, for example, in relation to how to proceed to establish bioethics committees. Materials on ethics and healthcare. Materials on ethics and public debate. So this slide is then kind of synthesis of the different elements involved in the ethics education program. Mapping of experts, description of programs, core curriculum, proposal, educational resources and ethics training courses. And as stated here by Henk ten Hoffe, the aim is more and better ethics teaching programs. But that is also, culturally speaking, a very delicate thing. How do you tell, how do you communicate what should be the minimal standards for a bioethics course? It's a lot of diplomacy needed here. You can't just bang it in people's heads and say, you should teach this, and this should be, etc., etc. How do you communicate about that? Which values do you promote? Whose values do you promote? And here, a summary of the Assisting Bioethics Committee activity. And as you see, the importance of these databases cannot be overstated. Let me then end this presentation by going back to IBC. One of the responsibilities of IBC is to identify topics that should be addressed. And throughout the years, IBC has published a lot of reports on different issues. In Kenya in July, IBC is going to decide, okay, what are the new issues we should start working on? In July, two reports of IBC will be presented. The first one is a report on informed consent. The second one is just in a preliminary draft, it's on social responsibility. Going back to the 15 ethical principles I mentioned, I think the principle in this declaration, which in the years to come will be subject of the most heated debates worldwide, I think, is the article which addresses the right to benefit from scientific knowledge. WHO published in 2000 a report on macroeconomics and global health where they refer to this so-called 10-90 gap. 90% of the world's resources in biomedical research is used to research diseases afflicting only 10% of the world's population. And these 10% is among the most affluent ones. Probably this is the case for scientific activities in general. And if you start digging into or taking this article seriously, then a whole range of rich Western countries will get into big trouble. This is the last slide. So the way the division proceeds is from these declarations, which is drafted by IBC, then goes to the IGBC, because if that is the committee that has to decide, what can my country accept? And after the IGBC has then deliberated on that, it goes further to the Director General and then to the Member States. So it is a long, time-consuming procedure. But democratic procedures are time-consuming. Capacities building, ethics committees, legislation guidelines, ethics teaching, awareness raising through publications, through these databases, and through the rotating conferences, and then the outcomes we hope to achieve is then at the right-hand side of this slide. Let me just finish by mentioning, before coming to Paris, I was head of a research center in biomedical ethics in Oslo with 20 people. That is a national center. The division has, in total, 9 people working. So in spite of the fact that ethics is the first priority area of UNESCO, we are very few people. And one of the implications of that is that we have to travel a lot. But it would certainly have been much better to have a bigger group of people responsible for this activity. But even in the field of ethics, you need resources, you need money to be able to do the best possible work. Thank you for your attention.
Well, thank you very much for an absolutely fascinating presentation, which has also kept exactly to time. And these are the two qualities which every conference organizer seeks in a presenter. We have a brief break in a minute, just so people can use the lavatories, which are where? Out on the left. This is a somewhat important announcement that traditionally made at conferences. I do want to draw your attention to the packs which we handed you. You will find many things in there. Some of you have been leafing through them perhaps already. We do have a copy here of the declaration, so if you haven't memorized it yet, it is available, and we might be able to read it antiphonally later in the afternoon. We do have here also a list of those who had registered for the conference, and so you know who you all are, and you see something of the range of organizations represented here. And there's also material which announces the next in our symposium series, which is on the 1st of May. It is a Tuesday afternoon, for a change, again here I think in this room, when our focus is to be on comparative European approaches to pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. And our keynote speaker, who was, I see, named as the editor of the French volume on the declaration, is Judge Christian Beek, whose name will be known to many of us, and in fact who has presented at an earlier conference organized by BioCenter some years ago. He's a friend to many of us. And he had a particular role, in fact, in the determination of the European Convention, which we're looking at later. But Judge Beek is speaking, as well as some other presenters, looking at comparative approaches to PGD. So that's coming up in May as our next event. But we now have a brief break for just perhaps 5-10 minutes at the most for people to stretch their legs, use the facilities, and then we will reconvene for our next round. Thank you very much.